हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सनि गौर भक्त वृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
Bottom of 32. Maharsh Prakrit was experienced enough to drive away Kali from his field of activities and thereby make the state receptive to spiritual enlightenment. If the common people are not receptive, it is very difficult to impress upon them the necessity of spiritual enlightenment. Austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness, the basic principles of religion, prepare the ground for the reception of advancement in spiritual knowledge. Right? So these things are useful because they create a receptive environment. That's the advantage. So all these religious elements, right? That's their purpose. It's not that religion stands on its own. It's that religion is important because it supports or makes one receptive. Right? But only you have to engage it in the Lord's service. So the reason we talk about it so much and the importance of Dharma is because it'll create an environment in which people are, it's more easy for people to be God conscious. Right? So just for example, we go out on Lake Prabhupada, you know, you go out in 71, you go out in Harinam with a bunch of Western devotees, everybody comes out in the streets, it's wild, it's a festival, it's amazing like that. You know, people invite you to homes, there's prasad, there's, you know, everything goes there. You can lecture, you can talk about Krishna, everything. Why is it? Because they're following the religious element. So they're receptive. On their own, they may not do it. But if you do it, they're very comfortable with it. Does that make sense? That's the difficulty of religion. On its own, it's nice. They may not be spiritual. But if you're spiritual, they'll follow. So they're receptive, yes.
Sometimes we describe pretty much anything as religion because it's about connecting with something greater than yourself. So maybe even going.
What do you mean by when you say we?
It's heard, it is done. I don't mean anyone in particular.
Oh, okay. Then the point is that you first have to know what religion means to be able to talk about religion. Because most people take a particular, they call it a body of beliefs or a particular ritual or lifestyle. But the thing is that's only an aspect of it. And even that, they don't understand how that's religion. Right? That the living entity is dealing something to uplift himself. That's the nature of the soul. That's the nature of human life. That's the religion. Mm-hmm. Particular ritual they follow most of the time is made up. Yes. You know, it's very rare it's given. You know what I'm saying? In other words, Muhammad, he gave some things to do. Jesus was Jewish, so anything that any Christian does basically has nothing to do with Christianity. It's paganism, but it's their philosophy. Is monotheistic, but their religion is pagan. Right? Does that make sense? Jews, then there's things God told them what to do, and so then they do those things. Now, how much they add to that, that's another element. You understand? Hindu, that's given. Buddha, as we discussed yesterday, he gave the central points, but everything else you see today, that's been added from Hindu Tantra. You know, so the whole point is that people don't really understand. So the nature that you're going to do something, you have to lift yourself, that's religion. But how you deal, like say, how you deal with your car, deal with it properly, you regularly service, you drive at the proper speed, you know, you clean it, you do all these things, that's religion, because you're dealing with the nature, that you feed your dog so many times a day and he's comfortable, that's religion. That's, you know, you don't feed your dog, he gets nasty, right? You know, that's irreligion. You know what I'm saying? So the real point is people don't understand what religion is. So that's why they think just Hinduism is another body of faith, or the Varnashram is just another body of faith that you can change. Of course you can change, but the thing is built on eternal principles that don't change. Laws of nature don't change because of faith. You know what I'm saying? It means Francis of Assisi, bless his soul, and despite his desire, still could not fly like a bird. You know what I'm saying? You know, he could put his hands out and catch the wind a little bit, but we didn't see him. There was no case of him lifting off.
Flying into the sunset.
Yeah, no, it just didn't happen.
So what do we say to people who say that some football match in 1992 was a religious experience?
No, just tell them it gave an intense experience, but religion means, did it connect them with God? Did they think of God? If it made them think of God, then yes.
They sometimes name the football that he's like God.
Like is one thing. So it's just like, it's like Gucci. You know, it's like, you know, Dior, right? You know, the Ethiopian guy is selling it around the corner in Venice, right? It's like.
Significantly cheaper.
Yes.
In every way.
Yeah. So the point is like is one thing. Actually is another. He's like God, but he's not making the sun come up and go down. And that moment, okay, he, you know, for that moment you felt that presence. But then after that, God always has that presence. Mm. It's just a matter of whether you notice it or not. So the question. Okay, so the point is the value is because this makes it receptive. So this idea that this is religion. That's why I was mentioning that. And then sub-religion, what Western culture is based on.
Yes.
Or basically, say any culture other than Vedic, basically. Mm. Is that it's sub-religion. And then they'll take that as spiritual.
Yes.
But it's not. It is helpful in support to religion, which then makes the living entity receptive to spiritual. That's how it works. But on its own, it doesn't stand. We have this weakness that we try to make it stand on its own, that it's actually important on its own, when it actually is not. It doesn't connect you to Krishna, it has no value.
So anything except Vedic is on some level made up. There's some aspect that's made up.
It is. Even within Vedic, people speculate and make up. That's the point. So real, that's why it says, real religion is hard to find. That's the difficulty, because people want to adjust it according to their own needs, rather than take it as it is, as Prabhupada mentioned. Because as it is how it works. You know, there's as it is and how you want. You know, Bhagavad Gita, how I like it. You know, as I like it, right? You know,
the one who wrote the Bhagavad Gita, as I see it.
As I see it. Bhagavad Gita, as I see it, yeah. And so basically, according to Shastra, that is 100% basically of not much value. Because it's not about how I see it. It's Bhagavad Gita as our acharyas see it. You know, as the parampara sees it. That's what it is. And so they give it to you as it is. That's the clear vayamiti. But it was as I see it. Who cares what I see?
They will say time, place, and circumstance.
No, that's not time, place, and circumstance. That is, yeah, time, place, and circumstance. When was that time?
Mm.
Where was that place? Mm. And what was the circumstance?
Mm.
It's easy to say, it rolls off the tongue. All these things roll off the tongue. And they do that for a while until people figure out they don't work. Then they find a new phrase that rolls off the tongue. You know what I'm saying? That's all they're doing. And then the phrase that rolled off the tongue so well meant something to everybody. Everybody's using it. You know, the celebrities, the media, you know, the businessmen, everybody uses it. Then you can't use it because now it's not good. So these kind of temporary terms, you know, it's okay to use to communicate, but to base your philosophy on that, that's a little bit lame, at best. You know? So we have to be very, very careful here. That's what the Bhagavatam's about, is that what is not exactly in line you have to be very careful about. It's not that things can't be engaged. Prabhupada is very expert at engaging things. But the point is he engaged it. It itself was not the point. The point wasn't to use a dictaphone. He had to use a dictaphone. He grew up with a dictaphone. He just needed to use a dictaphone. You know, it's just pushing that button and just, you know, did something. No, it was useful. If there had been something else useful, he would have used that. But you're only using it. It's not your life. His life is not dictaphone. You understand? He engaged Western culture, but Western culture was never his life. You understand the difference? This is where the mistake is made. So it's just his words. Nice. But the point is you have to understand what the words mean. Otherwise, time, place, etc. What time, what place, what circumstance that you understand what's going on? The acharyas, they speak it's eternal. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about the difficulties coming up in the social fabric that is breaking down because of the emerging middle class. And this is written in 1860s. So what is this newness, this time, place, and circumstance that they're so wonderfully writing about? You understand? That's the whole point. It's pride. You have to be very careful.
All right.
Yes.
Can you please explain the difference between religion and spiritualism? In my preaching field, it's something which is very, very important to present accurately so people understand what is religion and what is spiritualism.
Spiritual is understanding Brahman, transcendence. You understand what is transcendental. So the Lord's transcendental, the living entity's transcendental, the material world's not transcendental. Religion is how to engage the natures of things, both spiritual and material, for the purpose of upliftment. So now the best of upliftment is spiritual. But you can also use religion just to uplift yourself to a better, material situation. You know, that's the lowest end of it. But its actual purpose is to elevate you to the transcendental platform. Like that. So in other words, it's a body of rules that explain how everything in the creation works. And so knowing how it works, then you can properly utilize it for spiritual. So you have to know what's spiritual so you know what you're dealing with. And you have to know what's religion, otherwise you waste your time trying to get things to work but it don't work. That's the point of religion. Religion tells you how it works.
So it's knowledge and practice.
Yes, it's knowledge and practice. In other words, the religion is the culture of applying the spirituality in your situation. Right? I mean, nowadays people are fudging around with, you know, cultures and families and communities and all that, not really getting much effect. A few people are getting, most people are not. Generally the ones talking aren't getting, the ones that are doing are getting. Right? So now the difficulty comes up as they're talking about it and they're trying this, trying that. Oh, well, if this didn't work, then maybe that works, but it's speculation. It never works. Why? Because they're not following religion. And then when you come along with a religion and say, this is how it works, they say, oh, that doesn't work. That's archaic. But religion's eternal. You know, so I'm saying you have to be very, very careful on this. So religion is the forms you do. You don't have to change religion to follow Vaishnava philosophy. Because everything is connected to the Lord. It's just that the Vedic religion is more effective for spiritual life than these others. It's more scientific. But you could take anything and connect it.
So religion really begins with rising people to the platform of goodness through behavior, attitude, respect, honesty, morality.
Yes.
So they can be ready to take more.
Yes.
And more.
Yes. But the important element is that it has to be connected to the spiritual. So you're taking that they're following religion, that's a symptom of human life, and a tato brahma jigyasa. So the difficulty is you get those who are religious, but not necessarily spiritual. You get those who can relate to the spiritual and can't relate to religion. So when you have one or the other, then with only religion you get sentiment, and only a spiritual you get mental speculation. You have to have a both. So it's just a matter of which to introduce. Generally, those who are religious, they're open to the idea of spiritual, but because the religion element is nice, they tend to not worry about it, because life's already nice. For those who don't follow religion, life's not nice. So then you give them the answers in the spiritual, and they like that, they go for that, but then the problem is because they haven't practiced religion, then introducing it into their lives is, you know, if you have a good crowbar, you have a fighting chance, you know. But otherwise, then it's very, very difficult.
Because the tendency nowadays, I mean, even in the West, in China, it's also that tendency that people have moved away from religion into the spiritual, and then what they think is spiritual, the yoga practice, the meditation, the mantra, everything is cool, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, there's nothing there. There's no substance.
No, but they're actually just other religious processes that they're not aware of. Yoga is just another religious process. You know, it has both, because everything has both aspects to it, because you have to have the philosophy, you have to have the practical, the culture. So yoga is just another system like that. Because unless there's the supreme, that's not spiritual. There's no such thing as spiritual that the supreme's not involved.
Because most people who do yoga these days, so that me, it's all about
mind. Yeah, no, it's, and me means the body, not the soul. Like that. And, you know, the body, the mind, that's all. So they have to be able to make a distinction between the soul and the body and mind. And Maharaj Parikit made this favorable condition possible. Thus, the rishis of Naimisharanya were able to perform the sacrifices for 1,000 years. In other words, without state support, no doctrines of philosophy or religious principles can progressively advance. Right? So that's why it's seen as the democratic environments are more open. So then a variety of things can advance, as long as they don't get too out of hand or really bother people or break laws. Right? So it is a good environment. Other environments could be, but it depends on the leadership, right? Because there, if the leadership is an elected thing, therefore they have to be very, very careful. But in ones that it's not exactly, then they may or may not support. But the point is governance should create this favorable environment. Yes.
So we should be preaching to the governments, or I mean.
The point is you know, if you're able to deal on that level, then you do. Don't go out of your way. You know what I'm saying? You have to know what to say to the government. Right? Bhakti Tirthamaraj, in one place, he flew into this one country, I'm not sure, maybe it was Zimbabwe or something, flew to the airport, called up, got himself a limousine, you know, big limousine. Then with his limousine, drove straight up to the presidential palace. Because he was in a limousine, they let him in. You know, and he dresses good, he looks good. You know, and then he went in and got audience with the president, you know, gave him a Gita and then pre-speak to him. So he did okay. Now in West Africa, then in one of the countries, I don't remember what it was, they told, you know, somehow or another they got to the level they were dealing with somebody on the government level, and they said, you know, we're the Brahmins, we're supposed to tell you what to do. The next day the government showed up with a SWAT team and shot all the devotees. So you have to kind of know how to do this. You know? So it's delicate, it's got a risk, you know. So, you know, do it right, it works out great. Don't do it right, it doesn't work out quite as good. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So that's the whole point, is that the places where we can perform devotional activities, then the government gets some benefit for having created an environment that can happen. Because some places you can't, like Singapore. You can't go into Singapore. Right? You know, so they don't get any benefit from that. Other places, despite whether they're directly seeing the benefit or not, they're getting benefit. Right? Because in other words, if the state creates an environment that you can, they get benefit. Mm. That's mano. Right? There should be complete, okay. In other words, without state support, okay, no doctrines of philosophy or religious principles can progressively advance. There should be complete cooperation between the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas for this common good. You see, it's like, let us take Roman Empire, early Christianity, not working out so good except for the, what do you call it? Particular functionality of Christians as lamps, you know, road lights and lion food, right? Or you know, like you say, early entertainment, right? That. But I think they were only entertainment as long as they were Jewish, right? So there's a connection between the Jews and the entertainment industry.
Yes.
Right? As soon as Paulism came in and they became pagans, then I don't think that they were much, the entertainment value went down. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But as soon as the state took it up, you know, 400 years later, then, they, you know, everybody became Christian. So that's Prabhupada's point. If there's this cooperation between the leaders of society for spiritual life, then it goes very easy.
Yes.
Like that. As mentioned in chapter 17, Maharaj Parikit asked questions 23 and 24. King Parikit asked Kali to identify himself, then ask if he dared beat a cow and bull because Lord Krishna and Arjuna are out of sight. 5 and 6. He then asked the bull to identify himself and ask if he is really a demigod. He asked to cut off three of the bull's legs, 7 and 12. The philosophical significance of the questions and answers of chapter 17 are summarized thus in five parts, as derived from the first through the 45th verses and their purport. 1. Kali continues because no Kshatriya king is present to suppress its irreligious activities. Such a king rules according to the scriptures and never allows offenseless creatures to be disturbed by irreligious offenders. Right? So that's all. So this is cows. If he was bothering ladies, he would get, you know, children, old men, Brahmins, anything. Point is these are the ones he's going to protect. Right? So that's the such a. And if one is there, then Kali can't do anything. So does that make sense? In other words, the devil is not stronger than God.
Yes.
The devil is not stronger than God's laws.
Yes.
This idea that they're on equal par and all that, no. You decide you want to do, you can, by following the things, not be affected.
Yes.
Right? That's how it works. But you don't follow, you will be affected. It's his age. Right? It's his time. Right? That's the whole. 3. Sometimes to prove a point, as the Lord did when he put Bhumi and Dharma in trouble to demonstrate to the world that Maharaj Parikit was the real executive head, the Lord uses his devotees and even causes them distress. It's a matter of it causes them distress. He creates a situation of distress. Right? Because the point is there's no, how you say, cause of distress. I mean, she's the ultimate cause, means behind it, but the devotees aren't distressed by it. As such, does that make sense? There's a distressor, means the ability to perform your service nicely and all that is not going on. So Dharma is not able to perform because three legs are missing, right? So then Parikit has to put those back, right? Bhumi is then missing that association of the Lord. Therefore, she's having this feeling of separation. So now people are acting irreligiously, right? Because she holds up everybody, she gives support. So it's very nice giving support to those who are nice. It's more difficult giving support to those who aren't nice. You know what I'm saying? The mother will take care of those even who are not nice, right?
Yes.
Right? The children who don't behave nice, she still has that affection, but it's more difficult. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
It seems to be that there are different levels of distress, because some devotees, when they're distressed, they can't even chant, they can't go, they can't wake up, and some others, it appears to be okay, but internally it's the whole thing, and then, you know, different levels. So how should we react to the distress, actually, when it comes? Because we understand it's from Krishna.
Yes, yes. Means, so as we mentioned, Krishna may put one into a distressful situation.
Yes.
Now, depending upon your position, is how you respond. So now, how Dharma was responding, then Parikit Maharaj could understand this is the personality of religion. Right? So it's up to the individual how they respond. So if you let it get so carried away you can't do anything, it happens. It's understood. Things are very disturbing. But the point is you don't benefit from that kind of response. Right? As long as you're wallowing in your distress, you will be distressed. Right? You know, both physically, mentally, everything. Everything's just a distress. If you go take to the next level, you mentioned, you go on as normal, and you know, the distress is there, so in moments of when you're alone or with people who are close, it may be seen, then that's more cultured, like that. But that's basically what any cultured person does, right? You know, it's just like the mother may be having trouble in the house or the family, but the child doesn't see it. Right? That's cultured. You know, so these kind of things are there. But then the next step is that we understand is that this is just how the material world works. Right? Krishna's arranged this for something to learn, something to benefit. If we're not in that perfect stage, perfected personalities, like Dharma and Bhumi, then it's to give example to us. Right? So in other words, it's always for us. It's either what we're doing, it gets our benefit, or those who are advanced go through these things for our benefit. Does that make sense? And then if we're advanced, then we'll be doing what they're doing, so then it won't be a problem at all.
Is that means that Arjuna and Bhumi and Dharma, they never felt distress, actually?
Actually, because they're remembering the Lord and all that. So it's a different flavor. It's not your ideal situation. You know what I'm saying? But they're not distressed in passion and ignorance like the normal person is. They're distressed because of other things. Because Dharma is what will make it favorable for people to become God conscious. People aren't God conscious because it's not favorable. Right, the favorability is lacking. So then that scene is that gives an anxiety. So in the material world connected with, there'll always be an anxiety. Prabhupada mentions, even in Satyaloka, there's an anxiety. But we have to understand, it's a different anxiety. So here, when it mentions the Lord even causes them distress, it's a different category. It's not mundane distress. Right? It's distress over things going well, you know, in relationship to God consciousness, yes.
So there's no loss of identity?
No. That's where you see they can see who they are. Yeah. You know, Kunti sees who she is. Arjuna, now that's Yogamaya, or Yudhishthira, that was Yogamaya. So then in that case, then there may be that seeming loss of identity.
Mm. Yeah.
Is that some sense?
But that's for the Leela.
Yes, right. Okay, so we have to be very, very careful here. Having heard this chapter, then we have to understand the Lord uses devotees and even causes them distress means it's part of His plan.
Yes.
And it's His devotees are able to deal with it in a God-conscious way, because you don't have the full purports here. Right? Mm-hmm. We've already discussed that. So you have to be able to understand that these essential points are there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah? So that's the thing. It's about... Yes.
Maharaj, in this sentence here, it seems that the kshatriya is the key element to, as a society, to turn.
Means it practically apply, but what are they going to apply?
Based on the Brahmin.
Yes. It's just like, let's say, you have a man who, it's just like you have the chauffeur, he knows how to drive the car. So why does the car go where it goes, and why does it go so nicely, and why do you avoid traffic, and... You know what I'm saying? Why do you get no parking tickets and no speeding tickets? And why is the car, in, you know, it always in good shape? You know, you go to start the car, there's a nice sound is there, or if it's a Rolls, no sound, you know, like that. But the point is that's the element. Is that why is that? Because of the driver. Where is the car supposed to go? That's because of the guy in the back seat. Does that make sense? So... That's the whole point, is that the Brahmins don't run society, the Kshatriyas do. But the Kshatriyas take advice how to run. They know how to run it, but because when you're running things, you may miss things because you're so absorbed in the detail. You know, you're doing one thing, so you're absorbed in that, you don't consider other aspects. The Brahmins aren't, so then they can see the whole picture. So yes, that's a good direction, or no, this element is now becoming prominent, you have to add that, or you have to switch. Like that. That's the need of the Brahmins. But they have to be Brahmins who understand administration. You can't just have Brahmins who don't. And that's the rule. Bhishmadeva says this, the Brahmins that advise administrators are Brahmins who are trained in administration. It means in the rules of it, in law. Right? So those who know law, they can advise. But others, you take them for whatever they can do. Like you're going to do a ritual, then those Brahmins will do. Or astrological, those will do. like that. Does that make sense? You know, the family guru takes it. But the point is for administration, it has to be those who know that. They can give advice how the Shastra applies in the situation. Because it has to be, as we mentioned before, time, place, circumstance. This concept of time, place, circumstance comes from the Veda. Modern man tries to take credit, like, you know, apples fall off trees and go down. Newton tries to take the credit. No, they've always been going down. You probably check in Almaty, you know, where they've been growing apples before anybody else grew apples. Then they'll probably go back thousands of years and say, yes, apples always fell. But no, they said, no, they always, you know, when they'd fall, they'd float around and all that. And real problem, you know, he says, you're running along, you're hit in the face by this floating apple. It's really a problem. But then one day, sometime in the 1700s, they suddenly just dropped to the ground. It was wet. And we had a national festival. Right? And then you check up, find out that was connected with Newton when he was sitting under the tree. Yeah, no. That's the whole point, is that people try to take credit. The modern culture tries to take credit for what's already God's. You know? That's the thing. Yeah. 4. The importance of a qualified king in removing the influence of Kali must be understood by the citizenry, who should not succumb to sentimental, ineffective programs of social reform alluded to by Srila Prabhupada in the sentence from 25th purport, which is a reference to a pseudo-spiritual political ploy. Pseudo-spiritual political ploy. He comes up with such good... yeah. By which Mohandas Gandhi misled millions of Indian people. But it means it may have worked politically, but spiritually, then India's been a mess since that time. Right? Before that, they did have some spiritual, you know, strength. After that, very minimal. Like, as he figured out himself. Right? It means that when he died, he didn't die a really enthusiastic man.
No.
Right? He was not inspired, because he saw that all these, you know, leaders of society going along with his philosophy was only for political gain. As soon as then they got in power, then everybody did their own thing and nobody cared about his villages. They all supported villages. But the first thing that the first prime minister did was switch to industrialization. That's the first thing he did. So every country on the planet, all the first world said, don't do that. Your real strength is in your cottage industries, is in your villages. It's so strong. We don't have that. That's why we industrialize.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You got 10 people to get something done. You have to have an industry. You got so many people that can do these things. These are very valuable. Right? But the first prime minister decided, no, we're not. This is just a trick to keep us down. Like that. No, it was... What they didn't catch is that the cottage industries was a threat to the industrialization. That's why the British closed down so many of them. So now here's the chance to bring them back up and take over. But he wasn't intelligent enough. So this is the problem.
It's funny that now that anything which is handmade is so valuable.
It's so much more. It's all cost way more. But he was under this illusion. So therefore, then the problem comes. So that's the point of pseudo-spiritual political ploys. You know, it's well-intentioned, but it doesn't get to work. It has to be spiritual to be spiritual. You know? Like that. You can't. So all these different elements of sentimental, ineffective programs of social reform, we have to be very, very careful, because they're sentimental. They're not based on philosophy. They don't have a solid grounding. But people take them up because they sound like, oh, I'll get some immediate benefit. One has to be... Yeah, so, but that won't remove Kali. Only this proper king. Right? Such a king rules according to the scriptures. In other words, Kali continues because no Kshatriya king is present to suppress his religious activities. The king that can suppress his activities is one who rules according to the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And never allows offenseless citizens to be disturbed by irreligious offenders. Right? So when people come up, it's not that they're speaking offenselessly and then people pull the first in the Constitution. The First Amendment. Oh, freedom of speech. No, freedom of speech means you actually have something to say, you should be able to say it. You're speaking nonsense, that's not allowed. Right? If it's going to disturb offenseless people, that's not freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
That's a disturbance.
Freedom of speech comes with responsibility.
Yes, with responsibility. So the point is that you have to take responsibility for what you're speaking. Like that. Fastings, which are meant not for self-realization but for some other purpose, are condemned in the Bhagavad Gita 17:5-6. In the absence of a real leader like Maharaj Parikshit, the systematic education offered to the citizens in the Bhagavatam and the performance of Sankirtan Yajna will accomplish the same. Right? So if you don't have a real leader like Maharaj Parikshit, then systematic education, according to Bhagavatam, and Sankirtan Yajna. So if you have Sankirtan and the discussion of Bhagavat philosophy, that will correct everything else. Does that make sense? But if you try to... And the religious leader would be able to establish that. So if you're establishing a governance that doesn't do that, then it's not real. If the government isn't looking how to establish the Bhagavatam and Sankirtan, and this way then the common citizenry will be uplifted, it's not real governance. 5. Cooperation between the brahmanas and a bona fide kshatriya ruler will bring success to the state. Right? Like that. Okay, that ends that chapter. Essay question's a little shorter. Last time was half a page.
More.
But it doesn't mean that it's any easier.
No. Probably not.
Okay, chapter 18. Maharaj Parikshit cursed by a Brahmin boy, Pratigya. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.18.24. We see it going. You have these elements. It starts off with these elements that are disturbing, but there's that aspect of the connection with the Lord. Mm-hmm. Now you have these elements the same, but it's the influence of the Lord is not there. You see, it means the individuals, yes, but it's like Uttara is there. She's in distress, but the Lord is there. Right, the Pandavas are in distress. Right, Ashwatthama just killed their kids. Mm-hmm. Right, but Krishna's there. Yes. Right, you know, Yudhishthira's in distress. Bhishma, but Krishna's there. Yes. Right, but then we see now after Krishna left, the same distresses. So this is, you know, this is just the real world.
Yes.
That's the problem. So we can see the difference. You add the Lord, even the material world becomes wonderful. You take the Lord out, it's not wonderful. So you get these two flavors of with the Lord and without the Lord. So here, even Bhagavatam, we're talking Mahabharata, where we're getting the flavors of Sambhog and Vipralamba in connection with the Lord. In the context, the material world is always, you know, how you say it? Just a quote from one devotee. One devotee was telling another devotee, he says, Calcutta is so far behind, you know? Everywhere else in the world is advancing, you know? You look at, you know, New York, this, that, they're all so developed. Oh yeah, it was Bhavananda. And then he looked at the other devotee and said, no, he says, Calcutta is the cutting edge of what all the other big cities in the world are going to look like. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So it's just, you know, it's just the other side. Pratigya. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.18.2-4. Maharaj Parikshit was always consciously surrendered to the personality of Godhead. And therefore he was neither afraid nor overwhelmed by fear due to a snake bird, which was to bite him because of the fury of a Brahmin boy. 2. After leaving all his associates, the king surrendered himself as a disciple to the son of Vyas, Sukadeva Goswami. And thus he was able to understand the actual position of the personality of Godhead. 3. This was so because those who have dedicated their lives to the transcendental topics of the personality of Godhead, of whom the Vedic hymns sing, and who are constantly engaged in remembering the lotus feet of the Lord, do not run the risk of having misconceptions even at the last moments of their lives. See, the thing is, fear means you don't know what's going to happen, or there's afraid of a loss of something you consider valuable. But if you don't consider the material situation valuable, what's the loss? You know? Does that make sense? You know, if I come in and knock on your door, and you know, and I have two or three people, and we're all looking very grave and all that, and you know, it's like, what's wrong? You know, it's very serious like that. And you say, well, what happened? you've come to take away the rotten pumpkin in your kitchen. You know? And then at that point the guy, you know, falls on the ground and weeping and, you know, right? Is that how it works? No. This guy, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, great.
Thank you.
I was wondering how I was going to get rid of that. You know, so that's one aspect. Two is if you're going to a situation that you have interest in, it's not a problem. Just like the distance. Let's say if you were, let's say here on the ground, okay, and I've got this contraption, you know, and I put it, you know, around your shoulders, and it will, in like basically just a fraction of a second, lift you from the ground way up to the third or fourth floor, right? Just like that. Now, are you going to be scared or not? Possible.
Yeah.
Okay? But now you think about it. Now, you have a baby, and you have a mom or a dad, and then they just reach down and pick you up. Is the baby afraid? No, because of the relationship. You understand? So you combine that, the situation, it's not that the baby is so attached to sitting there in that spot on the floor and it just really doesn't want to move. Right? Because of that affection. So that's the thing. If there's no attachment to here and there's affection for there, there is not a problem. So Brigham Maharaj, for him, it's not a problem. There is no fear.
Yes. That's why babies laugh.
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure that Brigham Maharaj laughed when Dr. K came, but the point is... Yeah. Okay. Vritti, commentary. A philosophical elaboration upon the Pratigya. Okay. Verse 2 and 3 of the Pratigya glorify King Parikit's fearlessness and renunciation. These qualities evince his rasa for hearing the topics of Sri Krishna. Srila Jiva Goswami elaborates in Bhaktisandarbha, Anucheda 250, Part 4. As a parasol bearer follows a king, so renunciation follows these descriptions of the Lord. In Srimad Bhagavatam 113, it is said, O expert and thoughtful men, relish Srimad Bhagavatam, the mature fruit of the desire tree of Vedic knowledge, literature. It emanated from the lips of Sri Sukadeva Goswami. Therefore, this fruit has become even more tasteful. Although its nectarine juice, rasam, was already relishable for all, including liberated souls. It was already so good, and now it's become better.
That's good.
Right? So renunciation just follows because they're so absorbed in the rasa. Right? Because when there's bhakti, there's renunciation. Right? So then the two go together. So the devotees renounce, not because it's something separate. It just follows bhakti. So the devotees naturally. The fruit of the Vedic tree is juicy, with the sweetest essence of that tree, an essence identical to the Lord himself. Some branches of the tree of Vedic Shastra are analyzed as material, others as, quote-unquote, spiritual. Shruti Shastra, like a tree, is most liberal in that it offers shelter to all sentient beings. According to where they take shelter under the many spreading branches of Shruti Shastra, sentient beings gather into different classes, sattvic, rajasic, tamasic, liberated and bound. But the fruit of the Vedic tree, Srimad Bhagavatam, is transcendental nectar. By the word, quote-unquote, transcendental, the term vastu, reality, is meant. Right? So there's the point, vastu, transcendental vastu. Hence, the very second verse of the book declares Atra paramo nirmat saranam satam vedyam vastavam atra vastu. Quote, herein, for those devotees pure in heart, the supreme vastu is realizable as it really is. End quote. As it really is, not as I see it. Sri Krishna has more to say about vastu in Bhagavatam 11.11.1. 11.11.1. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, My dear Uddhava, due to the influence of the material modes of nature, which are under my control, the living entity is sometimes designated as conditioned and sometimes as liberated. In fact, however, the soul is never really, na vastuna, bound up or liberated. Since I am the Supreme Lord of Maya, which is the cause of the modes of nature, I am also never to be considered liberated or in bondage. Right? Because liberated means you were in bondage. So the Lord's not liberated because he wasn't in bondage. So the jiva is never bound and is never liberated. He's just always transcendental. But his consciousness, he becomes overwhelmed by maya, and then he thinks in a way that makes him... You know, in other words, a soul who thinks he's involved with the material energy, we call him conditioned or bound. Right, so when you say it gets more and more bound, it means more and more absorbed in thinking in this way. Therefore, the juice of the fruit of Srimad Bhagavatam is, quote-unquote, relishable for all. No matter if one comes under the Vedic classification of Baddha, a materially conditioned soul, or Mukta, a liberated soul. Both of these states are na-vastuta, since they exist only as designations of the modes of nature. Neither states are of ultimate reality. Does that make sense? So that's the fun part. In other words, designations are given so that we can relate to it. We work in a world of duality. So we work on designations. If there's good, there has to be bad. Right? So everything is organized like that. So these terms are used, and in one sense, they're not incorrect, but the problem is the natures we attribute to these terminologies sometimes aren't the full understanding. Right? Does that make sense? They don't have the full substance. So we always have to worry about that. That's why arguing over the words is not the point to do unless the acharyas are making a point out of it. Right? It's not a matter of arguing over the words. It's a matter of the principle that the words are. What's the intent? What's the principle? That is what is the point. But the word itself. If a soul, Baddha or Mukta, achieves relish for the fruit, divine qualities automatically follow his taste. Right? So that's the thing. They just automatically come. The Kshatriya qualities of fearlessness and renunciation. Wherever the Vedas teach them prior to the soul's gaining taste for the fruit, Srimad Bhagavatam, may be considered material products of the mode of passion. But Maharaj Parikit's fearlessness and renunciation are different. They follow his taste for hearing the descriptions of the Lord. Indeed, they offer service to that taste. Quote, as a parasol bearer follows a king, end quote. So writes Srila Jiva. Right? So this is the point is that the qualities the devotees are manifesting, that's coming from devotion. Because we see as devotees, well, manifest qualities they didn't have before. Like that. So it says, so you see this. I say, remember one devotee, he was, his background, you know, his purva samskar was basically, you could say, that of a, you know, a member of a motorcycle gang. Right? And so, you know, he was pretty rough and ready, but a real practical guy. And really good at controlling things and that. I remember one time, he and another devotee, similar kind of background, slightly different though, had worked it out when they were cooking in the kitchen, this was late 70s, that to cook one puri, you used 2 paisa of ghee. You know? I haven't met anybody else who can do that. You know, he was that practical. But because he was so practical, and because of his basically cultural background, his practical presentation was so rough, hardly anybody could deal with him. I mean, literally, hardly anybody was his friend. Like that. But then, you know, as you go, then he just became, you know, more and more Shastric, more and more this, started writing books and everything like this, nice books, and you know, and then he got to the point where he was just a sweet, wonderful person who was not looking for any, because he was so sharp, anything you were doing, the way you were dressed, where you were standing, this, he would connect it together. Oh, well, this is that, so you're doing this, and you're there. Why are you doing this? Are you supposed to be, you know, it's kind of like, where did this come from? I'm walking down the road, you know, like that. And then all this, went, it's just nice interaction, Krishna comes and he stops, start talking about philosophy and everything like that. So that is the qualities of the devotee. You know, so the other was the conditioning, but this then comes up, this is just the qualities of the devotee.
Yes.
So that's the point, is that even though it's such a rough background, he became one of the sweetest, nicest devotees.
Yes.
You know, just always talking about Shastra. Like that. Yeah, so that's it. Okay. Thus, renunciation becomes a sthayi bhava, supportive mood of Shantaras. right? Because that's the first thing you're dealing with, is Shanti. You appreciate the Lord, right? And then from there, it will naturally develop into its whatever state. It may remain that way, as we see with the four Kumaras, or Sukadeva, or it goes on to a further aspect. Okay. Steinbach. So it's a supportive mood. So it's a fixed element. That's why we're saying it's part of the nature of the living entity. Here, Srila Jiva Goswami quotes two verses from Canto 12 and cites the commentary of Sridhar Swami. Hearing about the transcendental qualities of the Lord is described in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.3, 14-15. I have related to you the narrations of all these great kings who spread their fame throughout the world and then departed. My real purpose was to teach transcendental knowledge and renunciation. Stories of kings lend power and opulence to these narrations, but do not in themselves constitute the ultimate aspect of knowledge. The person who desires pure devotional service to Lord Krishna should hear the narrations of Lord Uttama Shloka's glories, qualities, the constant chanting of which destroys everything inauspicious. The devotee should engage in such listening in regular daily assemblies and should also continue his hearing throughout the day. So here is then Sukadeva is making this point that the point is to talk about the Supreme Lord, about transcendence. But in doing that, I use the medium of these stories of these great kings. Okay? So then they'll lend here, power and opulence. Right, to it, because then that'll be tasty. People like to hear about that. Rupa Goswami says there's two things that people like to hear about. It means if you have one of these two, or both, even better, is the conjugal rasa or chivalry. You know, so if there's some fighting or there's some romance, then everybody likes it. You know, and if you can put them both together, hey, it gets even better. Right. So then talking about these kings and all the different activities, you know, all these things come up. So then people are they're inspired to listen. But it's not about the stories. It's about hearing about Krishna. These stories talk about that. That's why they're heard. That's why Prabhupada says we have nothing to do with Nala and Damayanti. Great romantic story, but the problem is there's no Krishna in it. You know, that's the difficulty. Right? Srila Sridhar Swami comments, in this verse, the speaker describes the dynasties of the great kings. However, he does this with the desire to speak about transcendental knowledge, vijnana, and renunciation. Right? Renunciation means giving up the material attachment and being absorbed in spiritual. Okay. Elaborate descriptions of departed kings are not the ultimate aspect of knowledge, paramartyam. In the next verse, the words nityam anabhikshnam means every day. It shows that every day one should hear. Right? So he's saying every day you should sit regularly and hear. Right? And having done that, then the rest of the day you should also hear. That's Sukadeva Goswami's point. Right? Another 24 hours a day you should hear, but at least once a day you should sit and hear. Right? And then go on in other ways here. Whether one is a liberated soul or a conditioned soul, he should daily drink the rasa of Srimad Bhagavatam. Since everyone, Bada or Mukta, is urged to regularly hear the Bhagavatam, the Bada will gain the taste, the Mukta already has the taste and will increase the taste. Right? So in other words, the increasing of taste and attraction of the Lord happens for all living entities. It is only reasonable that rasa appears in the narratives at different levels to attach different grades of souls to Sri Krishna. In all Bhagavatam narratives, there is rasa. But just as there is a variety of rasas, so in the narratives of Bhagavatam, there are various tastes of sweetness that nurture rasa amongst various levels of listeners. As Sridhar Swami indicates above, the qualities of saintly kings are narrated in the Bhagavatam to help a listener be situated in vairagya, renunciation. Maharaj Parikit is a Mahabhagavata. His qualities, like Krishna's, are relishable. Hearing about King Parikit, as we are about to do in this chapter, can satisfy the senses of a receptive, though conditioned, listener. The rasa and rich qualities of King Parikit blessed the listener with a determination to give up engagements of selfish sense pleasure and instead use the senses and their objects for the pleasure of Krishna. And so you notice that the Bhagavatam, especially as it goes through the kings, it only stops in certain places. Right? It doesn't stop on all the kings. There's some significance there, some significance in connection with the Lord, devotional service, like that. How somebody came to devotional service, like Dhruva Maharaj, you know, like that. Parikit Maharaj is already, from the beginning, you know, before he's born, he's already God conscious.
That's
right? You know. This does not contradict the fact that on the whole the Bhagavatam is a narration of Sri Krishna's qualities. Because you have to be able to appreciate the qualities to hear the qualities. Right? So then these other aspects bring about that appreciation. Right? Of those qualities, his mercy is one of the most wonderful. Krishna's mercy is spread throughout the world by the devotees who chant his holy name. This increases the attachment of everyone to him. As we shall see below, Srila Jiva Goswami makes this very point in part 5 of Anucheda 250 of Bhakti Sandarbha. Thus, topics about great devotees, like Maharaj Parikit, glorified in this chapter 18 of Srimad Bhagavatam, are inseparable from the mercy of the Lord. Okay. So, this is Jiva Goswami. Here the word guna, qualities, means mercy and other virtues. The nature of the Lord's virtues is seen in the following statement of Bhagavad Gita 11:36. O Master of the senses, the world becomes joyful upon hearing your name, and thus everyone becomes attached to you. Although the perfect beings offer you their respectful homage, the demons are afraid and they flee here and there. All this is rightly done. Verse 4 of the Pratigya remarks that the Vedic hymns sing the glories of the Lord. Those who have dedicated their lives to the transcendental topics of the personality of Godhead, of whom the Vedic hymns sing, and who are constantly engaged in remembering the lotus feet of the Lord, do not run the risk of having misconceptions even at the last moments of their lives. So if we dedicate ourselves to that, then we won't have misconceptions. Misconceptions come up by not being committed to it, right? So if we're committed to the Vedic version, then there'll be no misconceptions. But if we're not, it means the Vedic version as given by the Acharyas in connection with Krishna. If you're only interested in the Vedic version and not necessarily about the Vaishnava Vedanta, then you can get distracted quite easily. Though it will always be Vedic. Right? One has to be careful about that. However, Srila Jiva Goswami points out in Tattva Sandarbha 26.3, the fact that Vedic hymns glorified Krishna before Sukadeva spoke the Bhagavad Purana to Maharaj Parikit in no way obliges devotees to seek support for the Bhagavatam in Vedic texts. The Bhagavata is Krishna's very own representative, as stated in the first skanda. Now that Krishna has returned to his own abode along with dharma and knowledge, etc., this Purana has arisen like the sun for those bereft of sight in the Kali Yuga. Bhagavatam 1.3.43.44. The Bhagavat is thus seen to be endowed with all virtues, as demonstrated in the verse, quote, the supreme dharma, devoid of all ulterior motive, is found in this Bhagavata. Bhagavatam 1.1.2. This fact is further demonstrated in the Muktaphala. The Vedas, Puranas, and Kavya give counsel like a ruler, a friend, and a beloved. But the Bhagavat is said to give counsel like all three combined. Thus, even if some consider other Puranas to be dependent on the Vedas, Kavya means poetry. You know, the nice narrations and everything like that. So that's the Puranas means the Vedas, like the ruler, means it gives very exacting elements. The Puranas then are like a friend because they bring you close to all the different things that are there and everything, you know, nicely like that. And the Kavya is like a lover because it presents it through all these emotional kind of representations. But it says the Bhagavat does all three. That's why we see the Bhagavata, Bhagavad, there's this parts that are very strong. You know, it's saying exactly how the material world is. At other times, then it's giving so much nice information and nice ways of this. And at other times, it's very poetic and very sweet. You know, so all these, Bhagavatam has all three. That's why it's the mature, ripe and the mature fruit of the Vedic wisdoms of Vyasadeva's writings. So he's put together all these others. But now he's put this together, has everything that everything else has.
The Upanishads, they're very cryptic and technical, but every now and then you'll quote from, say, Gopal Tapani Upanishad, describing the sweetness. So even within those scriptures, they have.
Every scripture talks about Krishna and that ultimate transcendental position. They all talk about it. The difficulty is that because it's not constantly discussing in those terms, people miss the point. That's the whole thing. Just like Manu opens with, it's not sin to kill animals and sacrifice that are authorized. Like that. And so one who thinks it is misunderstanding. But one who kills an animal not according to sacrifice, that's sin. Right? Like that. And then going through this whole thing of going all these different elements. Then at the end, then he says, but if you're a vegetarian, for someone who did 100 horse sacrifices and someone else for the same amount of time was vegetarian, they both get the same benefit. You know, and then he ends with this you know, nice little thing that, remember, moksha means I kill you, you kill me. Right? But people don't catch those end bits. Because they read the beginning, get the thing, bend the head around it, and then, hey, yeah, that's what I want. So that's the difficulty in these others, is people catch what they're looking for in the material platform. But Bhagavatam presents what you're looking for in the material platform as a medium of discussing Krishna consciousness, while the other ones discuss that and discuss Krishna consciousness. In other words, it's for the purpose of Krishna consciousness, but the two aren't blended. So then you can take that one section just on its own. You know what I'm saying? And which is commonly done. That. So they're blended. It's just like one time, one devotee, he got very inspired by what Prabhupada was talking about and everything about grihastha life. So he went through Prabhupada's books, everything on grihastha life he pulled out and, you know, formulated together, put it together nicely, and then presented it to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked through it, flipped through it, and said, a useless waste of time. Because he had extracted the points that just on grihastha and left the points about Krishna consciousness. Right, so he just took that, okay, the purport, you know, there's these this little parts about grihastha life, and that he didn't take it in the context of the overall, of what philosophical importance that has, how that plays, how that uplifts. He just took those parts. So you really have to be careful about doing that. You know, you have to take it in its context. Otherwise, just on its own, so many things, you know. You take and put enough dots in between, you can turn anything around. You know, the buts, the ifs, the ands, and like this. You can turn it right around. Does that make sense? So that's the whole.
Yeah, the more technical shastras, they can give you expertise in a certain branch of knowledge, but to get the whole life of a devotee, then you need to.
Bhagavatam means they'll mention it, but in a short form. Because the Upanishads especially, they're meant for those who are really intelligent. And all this knowledge has to be applied according to this one verse. So how would do that? And then they would think and apply it and all that. And that's where you get your Smriti Shastras. Those persons who understand the Upanishads, and they discuss about the philosophy of the Upanishads in connection with practical application, that's where you get the Smritis. Does that make sense? So that's why they're important. That's why they're considered more important on one level, because then you see how to practically apply. But now, having practically applied, the Bhagavatam is the most important, because that's going to show how, as a devotee, you're going to apply Krishna consciousness into every aspect of your life. Right? So the Bhagavatam's point is it will discuss these, like Prabhupada's talking about, how the government can institute Krishna consciousness on a grand scale. You know? But it's meaning that it's about being Krishna conscious, valuing Krishna conscious, living Krishna conscious. You know, when he talks about Varnashram, it's not Varnashram without Krishna consciousness. So he's only discussing the Daivavarna ashram. Right? Devotees will then very nicely separate between Daivavarna ashram and not Daivavarna ashram, and then they'll apply that on Prabhupada's teachings. But that's a waste of time, because Prabhupada's only talking Daivavarna ashram. Does that make sense?
It's like they say food for life without then hearing the philosophy.
Yeah, because food for life. What's life? You know what I'm saying? You know, life begins at 40, so that means that you eat it and become 40 years old, or you know. I said, you know, and the other guy is what do you call it? Like I said, I saw that one poster in New York. There's this, you know, limousine, perfectly, you know, wonderful looking limousine. This guy in the, you know, this nice tux, you know, leaning on his limousine. He's got his thing of champagne like that, looking really good, and the caption said, "Poverty sucks." You know, so that's then they'll call that's living. So what does that mean, food for life? You know, it means just getting by. Microbes, they're alive. You know, so what's it mean, food for life? That's the point, is that we're just nice guys. You know, they're distributing food and they're nice guys. We're distributing food. We're also nice guys. So hey, we're all nice guys together. No, you know, we're distributing, you know, the transcendental, you know, food. We offer this to the Lord, sacred food. If they know that that's what they're eating, they get devotional benefit. If they don't, they get agyata sukriti. It's that simple. That's the difference. So that's the complaint of the Maharaj. Is that you're only giving them the unknown devotional credits when they could be getting directly devotional credits. Is this very rare you're going to find a guy who's hungry is going to not eat it because it's spiritual. I just only remember one time I went in and this guy came in and somehow or another, you know, those days, you know, you start off quite at a good clip when you start your discussions. You know, so when it's 74 Sunday program. And then somebody's explaining to him, says, yeah, and this food, you know, gets rid of all lust, and there's, you know, the spiritual world, there's no lust and everything like that. So by eating this and that, goes, no lust, no lust. He says, I'm not eating this. You know, it's kind of like, you know, what's life without lust? So he's like, but I only heard one case like that. Oh, no, two. Jimmy was the second one. I heard he also was not appreciative. Our guitar man.
It's Jimmy Henry.
Yeah. He also, I heard he didn't want to take prasad because they told him the same thing. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Anybody has some appreciation for Krishna, for Krishna, because Krishna is black.
Yeah, that works. You got to start somewhere, right? And he wears yellow. Now that can be related to. Generally, they don't wear yellow. More pink, but you know, white. But okay. Thus, even if some consider other Veda, Puranas to be dependent on the Vedas, the same supposition with regard to the Bhagavat is dispelled by the Bhagavat itself. This is also self-evident. Therefore, the Bhagavat represents the highest form of Shruti, as it is stated. So the highest form of Shruti means that aspect of Shruti that's discussing about the Supreme, directly. Right? Means the Shruti is only about the Lord. But you're talking about, like we get into discussing, you know, the rock, it's smooth or it's this or that, those particular things, then we're just talking about those other elements. And one may forget about the rock. Right? You understand? So the point is with the Lord, then it's about himself, but all the different aspects of his creation and everything. So one may forget. Because if you're going to describe how Krishna is the healing herb, then there's also the science of how to apply that. He is that science. But then in getting into it, discussing it, people could forget that it's Krishna. That's the weakness in the aparavidya. So that's why the Veda will mention the direct aspect, but people don't catch it. Right? Because more of the direct is mentioned in the Upanishads. And then you have to really just be into intellectualizing on it. So the Bhagavatam then is the actual point. Because then the Upanishads are condensed down into the Vedanta Sutra. So that doesn't really work much better, but it's more direct that you know you're going to get the right conclusion. But who does it? Right? So then Bhagavatam becomes. Maybe. As it is stated, Bhagavatam 147, this verse is counted as item 3 of question 7 in the study guide for chapter 4 of this canto. Katam va pandave yas, how do you go from a yasyur? I've never seen that.
No, that's
I've never seen a what, I mean, you have these things, but I've never seen one. Yas rajar share. Munina saha samvada samabhutata yata yatraisha satvati shuti. Because it depends who's speaking. You'll notice the Sanskrit is more technical or not. Because the Sanskrit is how those people speak. So you see these different ones are using different. Like certain ones, like Brahma, he always speaks in that, like Brahma Samhita verse, the 14 syllable verse. Like that. So depending upon who's speaking, you see they use a different kind of like style of Sanskrit. So some of them are really hard to read, and some of them are very easy. It's just a matter of the scholarship of that particular individual, how they like to present themselves, or how they like to speak, what's the audience, like that. So it's very interesting. Because most scriptures, they use one style for the whole literature. Like Gita, it's the whole literature is the same. But Bhagavatam, everything's different.
For example, Shoma Kumisha, he is speaking on behalf of somebody else, so he uses that type of Sanskrit when he recalls what they said.
That can be, but he's, in other words, he's a sage discussing about with sages, so he's representing sages, so he'll present it as they would you know, appreciate it. Like that. And Sukadeva is giving it also so that they appreciate it. But at the same time, when you're talking what Brahma says, you say what he said. You know, and because they're all shrutidars, then it is what he said. They don't have to worry. You know what I'm saying? They don't have to look and write, look and write. You know, they know. Didn't catch that word?
I did.
Okay. Yeah. So how did it happen that the king, Parikit Maharaj, the wise descendant of the Pandavas, met the Muni, Shukadev Goswami, who taught him the Satvata Shruti? The two words that close this verse are most significant. Satvati means transcendental. Shruti, that which is to be heard, is a term reserved for Vedic text. Srila Prabhupada here translates Shruti as the essence of the Vedas. In Srimad Bhagavat, so that's the essence. So that's the Satvata Shruti. The Shruti is the general, but the Satvata Shruti means specifically the essence of the Vedas. So that means the essence of the Vedas is Bhagavatam. So Bhagavatam is Satvata Shruti. Does that make sense? So the Bhagavatam is the highest of the Vedic literatures. Because that's all it is. Like that. That's why once you establish the Bhagavat, you don't have to keep referring back. Mm-hmm. It's only if there's a purpose, then we see. You know, like the Acharyas will want to show that the Bhagavat philosophy is grounded in the Veda, then they'll take it back to the Vedic verses. But other than that, then the Bhagavatam is the source. Right? Or, to get the other aspect, is they'll take it out to Vedanta, or they'll take it out to Gita. Right? Because you have the Upanishads, you have Gita, and you have Vedanta Sutra. These are considered the three evidences of philosophy. This is Prashtantraya. Means these three, this is where, means if you quote these, you can't go wrong. Like that. So, You quote them to establish Bhagavatam, then you can just quote Bhagavatam. But if you want to, somebody needs to go back, you go back to these three. That's why you see here. Acharyas are discussing Bhagavatam, but quoting Gita or quoting Vedanta Sutra. Does that make sense? Or Upanishads.
Upanishads.
Yeah? Right? Does that make sense?
Mahabharata is...
Mahabharata, it's the Gita from the Mahabharata.
Okay, so, yeah.
But that's the thickest. That means if you quote from these things, anybody who's a scholar in Vedic literatures will appreciate, at least who are Vedantists.
Mm-hmm.
There's no problem, because that's why it's called Prastantraya. It's universal. It's Shankarites, Vaishnavas, everybody. These are the three.
Yes.
Means by quoting those three, you can establish the position of Bhagavatam. Then once you've established Bhagavatam, then you can just establish the point on Bhagavatam. But when the acharyas want to bring out some other aspects, they always go back to those three. Right? Like when Prabhupada's in the purports to Gita, he quotes Bhagavatam. The purports to Bhagavatam, he quotes Gita.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right? We see the acharyas in their commentaries are always quoting Upanishads, Gita, and Vedanta Sutra. You know, and Prabhupada will do that as, because you know, that's just the etiquette. We're just thinking, oh, this is just what he's doing. No, this is the etiquette. We're thinking, oh, this is just, yeah, Prabhupada wrote, you know, Prabhupada doesn't know all these things like that. No, this is exactly. There's no scholar that can say this is not authorized. That's the point with Prabhupada's teachings. Like that. We haven't had anybody come and say. We may say, but actual scholars never say. Real Vedic scholars, they don't say. Okay. In Srimad Bhagavat Tatparya 4, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur provides an elaborate explanation of the term Satvati and why Srimad Bhagavatam is the original Vedic Samhita or Shruti. In ancient times, there was only one community of men known as Hamsa. The best among these were known as Paramahamsas, or travelers on the path of spiritual life. Previously, Vaishnavas were referred to as Paramahamsa. When we study the ancient history of the Bhagavat Sampradaya, we come to know about these Mahamsa and Paramahamsa. They followed a process that was known as Ekayana. Right? Ekayana means just fixed on the Lord, just one pointed. Because Srimad Bhagavatam was the subject matter for discussion of Paramahamsas, it is also known as Paramahamsa Samhita. That's another name for it. Does he get into here about he's gone.
It's a puff of smoke.
Yeah. That means when I turn back, it'll be there again. Okay. So just I think the prayers of the personified Vedas is the original, the core part of the Bhagavatam. You mean you have the Chaturshloki, and then his expansion is the prayers of the personified Vedas. And then from there expands everything else. Samhita refers to a compiled literature. The accumulation of knowledge from the five different sources found among the followers of Ekayana is called Pancharatra. Pushkara, Hayashirsha, and Narada Pancharatra are in this category. A worshipper of the Supreme Lord is known as Bhagavata. I am speaking about the time previous to when Srila Vyasadeva had spoken Bhagavatam to Sri Sukadeva at Samyaprasha. Srimad Bhagavatam was first spoken by Sri Narayana to the great sage Narada. This took place at the village of Kalapagrama in the Himalayas, as recounted by Srila Sukadeva in chapter 87 of Canto 10, text 4 through 48. Narada then related it to Vyas, who spoke it to Sukadeva. From that time onwards, it's been known as Srimad Bhagavatam. Before that, it was known as Paramahamsa Satvata Samhita. From the writings of Srila Vyasadeva, we hear of literature like Paramahamsa Samhita and Satvata Samhita. Veda Vyas composed the Puranas to make the understanding of the Vedas easy. The Puranas are full of ancient histories. Srimad Bhagavatam, composed by Srila Vyasadeva, is also one of the Puranas. But It is the only literature that supports the Ekayana system, and so it is also known as Pancharatra. Right, so because for us, the Pancharatric system is just part of what we do. Right, that's why the Pancharatric and the Bhagavat go together so well.
The Bhagavat Purana,
Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Purana, Paramahamsa Samhita, Sattvata Samhita, Paramahamsa Sattvata Samhita, they're all the same work.
Brahma Sutra?
Brahma Sutra, that is the taking the essence from the Upanishads and putting it in aphorisms. That's Vedanta Sutra. So it's a philosophical treatise done in aphoristic format. Well, the Bhagavatam is Ekayana, is Pancharatra, but it's done in Puranic format. So that's why it's classified amongst the Puranas. But it's actually, it's the original Vedic literature, you could say. Does that make sense? There are two main branches of the Vedas. The Ekayana, one path branch, and the Bahvayana, many path branch. The Paramahamsa Bhagavatas, who belong to the Achyuta Gotra, are counted as members of the Ekayana branch. The sages from the Chuta Gotra are counted as members of the... The sages from the Chuta Gotra, there's the Achyuta and the Chuta, are counted as members of the Bahvayana branch. Achyuta means infallible. So the fallible, the sages from the fallible branch, which means the many branch, means the mundane, your fruit, your jnana and karma, branches of your jnana and karma, are completely different from each other. These two branches, Ekayana and Bahvayana, are completely different from each other. When in the Ekayana system, the worship of the one Supreme Lord is encouraged. When the understanding of spiritual truth becomes distorted in due course of time, the division of the Vedas and Varnas come into existence. Right? Otherwise, it's just you just have one. You don't need others. Like that. But when it becomes distorted, then when it becomes into this, the Bahvayana, then you need the Vedas to be broken down so that then they can go into their various branches, because that's their whole point, is that it's about various, but again, it becomes difficult. So then by this compilation, you make it easy for those of the Bahvayana, and you make it easy for the Ekayana, because then you have Bhagavatam, and then you have everything else. Interesting to note is modern religion, though philosophically they're Ekayana, but as far as the religion goes, they're Bhagavayana. Yes. That's interesting. Yes.
So, before this Varna were divided, it was mainly worship like Bhagavad worship.
Yes, Ekayana means simply focused on the personality of God. That's Ekayana.
Means without any rituals.
It doesn't matter, even if there are. Ekayana means like Pancharatra is Ekayana. So rituals are there. But the ritual is only a connection of what's connected to the Lord. You don't have a Soma Yajna in Ekayana.
Yes.
Right? You don't, that's Bahvayana. Does that make sense? So worship of the deity, these things, that's Ekayana. Yeah.
Can we say direct and indirect?
Yes. Like that. Yeah. In the Ekayana system, the worship of the one Supreme Lord is encouraged. Before Treta Yuga, there was no division of Varnas. Everyone was in the category of Hamsa. As enviousness towards Vaishnavas gradually became prominent, the Vedas were divided, and the one community of Hamsa became divided into different Varnas, headed by the Brahmins. Right? So within Ekayana, it's about the Supreme. And within that, worship of the Supreme Person is recommended. But as there became a difference in the mood, as you go into Treta Yuga, then it became separated. Then you had the Vaishnavas and the Brahmins. So then you get Ekayana and the Bhagavayana. Mm-hmm. Let me go back to ancient times. The Ahimsa community used to live in that part of present-day Asia that is situated near the Kasyapa Lake. That's what I was going to ask, if it tells that way. Situated near the Kasyapa Lake, now called the Caspian Sea, in the region of modern-day Iran. At that time, they were known as Aryans. Right? So Iran means it's just their way of pronouncing Aryan. And then you have a group, a subgroup within that. They're called the Alans. That also means Aryan. So that's all about. So that was where they were situated. Because down here is Puni Bhumi, where you perform the activities. They weren't performing any karma, so they stayed up there in that whole kind of northern region. That time, because they were engaged in the worship of demigods, such as the fire god, they considered the worship of Lord Vishnu to be similar to that of the worship of the demigods. Worship of the demigods, along with the offering of prayers, is found in various scriptures, such as the Vedas and Samhitas. One who wants to properly understand Srimad Bhagavatam should know this. Otherwise, one will certainly consider Bhagavatam to be just another medieval book. Srimad Bhagavatam is the only Veda that propounds the Ekayana system. Words like Ekayana, Mahabharata, and Pancharatra are found in the Upanishads. If one studies the history of the world before the appearance of the Bhagavatam, we know that human beings were civilized worshippers of the Supreme Lord even before the time of the Rig Veda. People in ancient times were spontaneous devotees of Lord Vishnu, and they remained fixed in the philosophy of Vaishnavism. In the beginning of Treta Yuga, the Ekayana system became obscured and the Vedas were divided. The Ekayana system is more or less extinct at present, but if a study is carefully made, one will come to the conclusion that before the Vedic age, devotional service to Lord Vishnu was prominent amongst the people. Other paths and opinions, right, because that's why they find all these things of worship up there that they can't figure out how they got there. In the beginning, okay. Yes.
Is there a period to this congregation of sages on the Caspian Sea? Is there a period, a date?
Before Treta Yuga.
Before Treta Yuga.
It means in Satya Yuga, that's all it. When Treta Yuga, then, because you're starting yajnas and rituals dividing the system, then you have to manifest all this, otherwise, so then they move down into Aryavarta. But before that, they're Paramahamsas, so they just stay up in the mountains. So that's the, and of the mountains, that's pleasant and nice, you get nice melons there. All the really, really nice fruits and everything all come from that area. They're very special. You don't get them anywhere else in the world. So it's a very nice place like that. That's why over the Caspian Sea, that side, you have there from that line that then when it happened, so people did stay there. There were kings there, and then one of those kings became, from his people, so impious that the Brahmins took all that impiety and took that from him and placed it in the tree. And so everybody knew, stay away from that tree. So when Kali Yuga came, and then at another time, then I think one king was killed by all these tribals, these Malechas. So then his son did a Malecha Yajna, just like the Takshaka, the snake, killed his father. So he did a snake Yajna to kill all the snakes. So this was killed by Malechas. So he did the Malecha Yajna, killed all the Malechas. So there just weren't any. So when Kali Yuga came, there were no Malechas. Right, so then how are you going to have Kali Yuga without Malecha? It doesn't work. Kali needs some backup here. So then he went to that place where that tree was and inspired the local prince, whose name was Adhama, and he and Havyavati. Then they took whatever was the fruit on that tree. Nowadays they say it was an apple, but whatever it was. And then, because if you touch that tree, eat the fruit from the tree, you get the sin from that. Now they became sinful enough, now they could function as malechas. And then, because of that, because there they didn't agree with such particular mentalities, so then they were kicked out.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. That's Bhavishya Purana, and then you see this connection here, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is making. So, therefore, it was the beginning, but that's why it just starts at that one point. And even though Adam and Eve are the first man and woman, there are no other men and women, when they have their sons Cain and Abel, they marry them to the local village girls. The verse is right there. You know. So what does that mean? Okay, so they're the first ones of this, you know what I say, the chosen race. Yes.
Like that.
Excuse me.
Sorry?
Excuse me, I just have a question. In Satyayuga we hear that they're all Paramahamsas.
No, they're all Hamsas. Now of those, there are Paramahamsas. Right, so the Mahamsas are, you know, absorbed in the Brahman platform and this and that, and the Paramahamsas are absorbed in the, you know, the devotional platform. But they all deal, according to the Vedic things, and, you know, all the demigods and this and that, but they're all seeing what's beyond that. They're all seeing the transcendental platform.
So my question is, because the Varnashram comes in after Satya Yuga?
Yes.
But is it true that there's personalities like the Tanapa, Priyavata, that?
But they're not here, they're above here. They're dealing with the universe. Uttanapada was king of the universe, not of Earth.
So just on Earth, they're all sages and rishis?
Yeah, yeah. At that time. Then it drops down. But otherwise, you know, means Swayambhuva, as you could say, your first, like, Kshatriya. Like that. So Swayambhuva Mana, so the first son of Krishna, Brahma. So then he's there, like that. So you have both these Brahmins and these sages and the Kshatriyas. So they have these moods, and so then they're the original. And so they're working on the universal platform. But on the earth, then you just have like that, and then you start the kings. Does that make sense? Yeah. It's not that you don't have something going on, but that's not the thing. You don't have to divide it. Because everybody, whatever needs to be done is done. You don't have to divide. You know, everyone lives simple, so then, you know, you don't require much. Does that make sense?
So is it that later, those dynasties, like from the sun god and the moon god, they descend on the earth?
They're already present. Once it starts, they'll descend in the first kalpa. But after that, then they just continue on throughout the day. You know, the next day they'd have to descend again, since everything's basically wiped out. Right? It works out. That's what Brahma has to do all day. So. Other paths, okay. The Ekaina system is more or less extinct at present, but if a study is carefully made, one will come to the conclusion that before the Vedic age, devotional service to Lord Vishnu was prominent amongst the people. Other paths and opinions began to spread only from the beginning of Treta Yuga. It is not that there were Buddhists and Jams.
Jams.
So does that mean the Buddhists, they were doing the jams? Or they were, does that mean like strawberry jam, or like you mean like a band jam?
Heavy jam.
Okay. It is not that there were Buddhists and Jains in our country long, long ago. In ancient time there were devoted Brahmanas that were only interested in topics of devotional service to Lord Vishnu. Descendants of these Brahmins nowadays identify themselves as Sasvatis or Sarasvatis, which is a corruption of the words Satvati. Before the arrival of five kinds of Brahmanas from Kanyakubja, there were many Satvat or Vaishnava Brahmanas in Bengal. Due to the strong influence of the atheistic philosophy of Buddhism, the spreading of Vaishnava religion became more or less checked. And yet, despite facing various obstacles, the ancient religion is again being propagated extensively by the mercy of the Lord. Jiva Goswami concludes that it's Anucheda 250. And in fact, that Vyas composed the Bhagavat only after compiling all the other Puranas, as stated earlier, can be verified by examining the dialogue between Vyas and Narada, as recorded in the first skanda. In Srimad Bhagavat Tatparya 3, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur leaves no doubt about the relation of other Vedic scriptures to Srimad Bhagavatam. One should discuss Vedic literature as being subordinate to Srimad Bhagavatam. Whatever one studies, be it literature such as Isha, Kena, Katha, and Samhitas, the Kalpas, grammar, astrology, or any other field of knowledge, if he keeps the Supreme Lord in the center, then all his knowledge will become transcendental. Otherwise, it will be mundane. So, simple. So the point is, it's about Bhagavatam, it means about transcendental, that's what's of value. The loss of transcendental, then it becomes mundane. Yes?
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Srila Prabhupada ki
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki
Jai Jai Gaura.